The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
Hey there, this is The Takeaway for Labor Day, September 5th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and we've got a special show for you on this Labor Day. A look at how immigration has shaped the workforce in our country, shaped the economy of our country, and also shaped its politics. And we begin, well, we begin, of course, on Broadway. It's not just the history buffs, but everyone in the pop culture world in general who's been touched and entertained and a bit shocked by how Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton have been going at it on Broadway in the monster hit show Hamilton, a story about how in the 1780s, an immigrant became the first U.S. Treasury Secretary.
How does the bastard, orphan, immigrant, decorated war vet unite the colonies through more debt? Fight the other founding fathers till he has to forfeit. Have it all, lose it all. You ready for more yet?
Treasury. The story is how the brash immigrant challenged Thomas Jefferson, who came home from being ambassador to France, and stepped right into a fight.
Cello, now the work at home begins.
Oh. Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's home, a real place in Virginia, where the work and the fight depicted in the Broadway show Hamilton about immigrants and so much more, all that continues today. On this rainy 4th of July, 2016, another set of immigrants visits Monticello, a former slave plantation. Slaves, that's a group of forced migrants and a pillar of the 18th century U.S. economy, a group who did not choose to be Americans, but on whose backs our nation was built. More about that later. We will hear the emotional swearing in of some immigrants who in 2016 are in the middle of a political fight of their own over the U.S. economy and the most important presidential election of the 21st century. But first, a reminder of that fight, Broadway style, between Alexander Hamilton, the immigrant orphan on the $10 bill, and Thomas Jefferson, who we think of as that genius president from Monticello.
Secretary Jefferson, you have the floor, sir.
Ow, but Hamilton forgets. His plan would have the government assume state sense. Now place your bets as to who that benefits. The very seat of government where Hamilton sits.
Not true. If we assume the debts, the union gets a new line of credit, a financial diuretic. How do you not get it? If we're aggressive and competitive, the union gets a boost. You'd rather give it a sedative.
You get the idea? This is all courtesy of one of the most honored Broadway shows in the history of the American theater. And it's the argument that underpins the U.S. economy to this day, from slavery to industrialization to the financial system that permits lending and stimulates growth and demand for labor, and all the immigrants who arrive on these shores and do the work of the changing nation. Here on this Labor Day, the real story of immigrant Hamilton and President and slave owner Jefferson, the drama of today in the faces and voices of the people now just joining the American story. Our entire show is given over to those in that off-Broadway tale, the people making today's America, immigrants. For something that has so defined this country, our system for dealing with immigration, you may have noticed, doesn't work. Somewhere north of 11 million undocumented immigrants live in the shadows right here in the United States. But first, back to that rainy 4th of July day at Jefferson's Monticello. With an invitation from the First Year Project, run by the nonpartisan Miller Center for Public Affairs here at the University of Virginia, the Takeaway had a front row seat to a very special ceremony. For more than half a century, this calm and quiet part of the state plays host to a patriotic pageant on Independence Day, a burst of red, white, and blue for its 54th annual Independence Day celebration and naturalization ceremony right here at Monticello.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light?
When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them.
Thomas Jefferson's words, one people, imperfect then, still imperfect now.
It's all here, all the symbols, here in the rain, swirling in the mist, all the colliding histories, identities, and symbols of America. Jefferson's home, his cathedral of liberty, but it was also a plantation that kept slaves. Immigrants being sworn in at a moment in history when America cannot find a way to clearly articulate to tell immigrants, welcome or to stay away.
Gathered under a beautiful explosion of colorful umbrellas on the sprawling historic West Lawn at Monticello, 75 people from 41 different countries with their families and friends are here to take the oath of citizenship. They're anxious to add their stories to the American narrative.
I grew up here. I was 4 years old when my parents first came here. They immigrated from India, and I was actually born there, but then was brought over here as soon as I was born.
My name is Eric Kalinga, and I'm from Zambia. Definitely excited, you know. I've been here for about 15 years now, so it's been a while, and also I've been fortunate to have a family here with three kids, so we realized that literally it was where God has placed us to make our home.
For me as a new citizen, it's about freedom, upholding freedom. It's about what our founding fathers, it's amazing as we're sitting here at Jefferson's estate, you know, what our founding fathers really wanted for this country. For me, it's that responsibility of upholding that.
Well, I was really little when all of that happened. When I was illegal, I was little, so I didn't really know that I was illegal, to be honest. I don't know. And then I became a legal resident when I was, it was in 2002. And that's when I was starting to understand more that I had become legal, and obviously because then I could go to Mexico and come back.
We've been moving like in 2 years we moved 7 countries. Just to be safe. I wish some people, they don't suffer like that. I wish.
The voices of Mayak Gala, Eric Kalenga, Yuridia Mondragon, and Nawal Alshama.
Ladies and gentlemen, I invite you to be seated. The program is about to begin.
Thomas Jefferson's own Chinese gong, housed on the rooftop of Monticello, struck at the top of the hour and marked the beginning of this ceremony. You know, this is the oldest continuous naturalization ceremony outside a courtroom in the United States.
Afghanistan. Barushi Gobitha Amar Asing, Argentina. Alexander Aharon Schult, Bangladesh. Shawan Suba, Bhutan. Fraxin Mumba, Bolivia. Juan Carlos Bisono.
I hereby declare on oath that I will support and defend the Constitution and laws of the United States of America. Congratulations. You are American citizens.
There was only warmth and welcome here in the rain. And one of the new citizens we met was Nawal Alshama. Nawal came to the United States 5 years ago, fleeing violence in Iraq. 7 different countries in 2 years to finally be safe and to reach the United States with her husband, daughter, and son. Nawal is both Russian and Iraqi.
Nobody say who I am, you know, Christian or Muslim or Russian or Iraqi or whatever I am. I'm going to be American. This is going to be important for me. I work in Walmart. I started like a cashier 5 years ago, and now I'm support manager. I'm doing very well in work, and I like it. And I wish I can, you know, work more. You know, I do something better than that. But I need the time. I just 5 years here. But I need the time.
Nawal, you should know, is a trained engineer running checkout at that Walmart, where it feels different sometimes from this welcoming spirit at Monticello.
I know there's some people, they just don't like us, or they like that, you know, another people here come, they because thinking that we are taking the chance for work, or we whatever they think, because I hear sometimes I hear that from many customers in Walmart. I hear that. But I wish those people change their mind, because we are a human being. We just want to be a normal human being. That's all what we need.
My name is Amjad Asturiya. I'm Palestinian. I was born in Iraq in 1981. And I'm 24 years old.
Amjad Asturiya came to the United States as a refugee 6 years ago. Having lived through the shock and awe of the war in his country, this was a different kind of awe.
I dreamed to go to America since I was a kid. Even before the war, was one of my dreams to go to America. But I don't know it's going to be like that. You know, I'm going to be to come to America as a refugee. But
are you Muslim?
Yes.
Donald Trump doesn't want you here.
I think maybe some people don't agree about what he say. But I see a lot of people, they love Muslims here. And I think if people love Muslims, I think I don't think it's a problem for Muslims unless the government don't want them anymore. But I think people, they do want us here and they love us. And but I don't think there's a difference between any religions here, like any religion here. I just feel that I'm one of them. I'm just one of these people who live in America. And
Monticello already held a special place in the hearts of one of the immigrant couples we met here.
My name is Harmon Kool. I am originally from the Netherlands. I've been here for almost 10 years now. This was already a special place for me because I proposed to my wife here, actually with the famous Nickel View. Being here today makes it just extra special.
It means a lot of things. It means, you know, we can go vote together come November. It means he can enjoy all the rights and privileges that come with being an American citizen, which is really wonderful that we can share in that. And, you know, America's a wonderful place, and we get to share that now.
75 people from all over the world on this July 4th, 2016, took the oath of citizenship at Monticello. And here's what Judith Christian, who came from the UK, had to say to everyone. She comes from a land, you know, now in the grip of all kinds of divisions over that Brexit vote to withdraw from the European Union. Judith articulated a message to everyone that shouted in the face of the rhetoric in this year's U.S. presidential campaign. And that's the first one, Judith, and they will all be able to vote in.
It's a wonderful day. I do feel that I need to also say that we must remember that but for a select few, we are all immigrants or descendants of immigrants. We are more similar than we are different. And on this day, I feel it's really important to remember that. So, thank you.
For beautiful, for spacious skies.
Coming up, more thoughts from immigrants on freedom and dignity and thoughts about what the next president will face in the year 2017 fast approaching. And an update on immigration as a campaign issue from our own Todd Zwillick.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org. Constant Contact, offering email marketing features like drag-and-drop editing and mobile-friendly templates. Constant Contact's products are focused on helping small businesses. More at ConstantContact.com.
Happy Labor Day. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm John Hockenberry. If you've been following the election campaign, you know well the face and voice of Dr. Larry Sabato, New York Times bestselling author, Emmy Award winner, founder and director of the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. He unabashedly admits he's got a bias towards Thomas Jefferson.
And if the university, the founding of it, the Declaration of Independence, the Statute of Virginia for Religious Freedom, the Louisiana Purchase, and the Lewis and Clark Expedition aren't enough to induce your thankfulness, then maybe you've forgotten that Mr. Jefferson helped to introduce ice cream and macaroni and cheese to the United States.
But Sabato is well aware of how our election season is a continuation of the fight over the principles of governance articulated by Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton way back when. Politics, he says, is not pretty, like a Broadway show.
I realize politics has a terrible reputation. Mention the word and dark visions of corruption, bribery, and smoke-filled rooms are conjured up. Here's a revolutionary thought, though, for your fourth. Politics in America is a good and necessary thing. It's the oil that greases the creaky machinery of government by encouraging responsiveness to public opinion. Without liberal application of politics, the centrifugal forces and the discord generated by diversity might rip apart the fabric of our society. Politics is simply the means we use to make our nation work and to make our states and communities better places to live.
Larry Sabato was the featured speaker at the Monticello ceremony, and I got a few words with him. I asked him, is it a message of welcome for immigrants that America delivers in 2016, or a message of stay away?
Fortunately, for much of American history, we did and have welcomed immigrants. We're perhaps at a different moment now in this particular political campaign. Ceremonies like this make it much more difficult for people to be as critical of immigrants as I've heard some be this year. If you need your patriotism renewed or your views of immigrants renewed, you come to a ceremony like this to listen to some of the stories that I heard. It just reminds you that many Americans who were born here take it for granted, and those who come here probably end up contributing more for the most part.
A lot of people we spoke with in the group said, boy, they were relieved they were getting this taken care of this year because they didn't really know what the situation was going to be in future years.
And that's really disturbing because our society in so many ways, socially, culturally, economically, depends upon immigrants, and they're feeling positive about becoming a part of America. You know, just the other day, a lady approached me in a grocery store, and she had not yet become an American citizen, and her son was trying to become one, and she was deeply disturbed by the rhetoric that she had heard on television this year, and we all know where it's coming from. Americans often complain that there's not a dime's worth of difference between the major party candidates. No one can say that this year. There's an enormous difference, and it's going to make America a very different place if one is elected as opposed to another. And so it's very important that people consider carefully in advance what they're doing, as opposed to, let's say, some people who voted on Brexit in Great Britain.
Do you think in the last few years, and with the rise of Alexander Hamilton as a pop media star, has Jefferson's reputation and some of his mythology taken a bit of a hit?
Jefferson has taken a big hit. And Jefferson was the author of the Declaration of Independence. The fact that he personally did not live up to all the words in that document does not make them any less important, any less profound to people yesterday or today. And all of American history has been an attempt to cause us, the society, to live up to them. So we honor Jefferson for the words, and I think we can honor lots of other people for helping us to live up to the words. When I first came to the University of Virginia in 1970, Jefferson was a demigod. You questioned nothing about him, and you accepted the official version of everything. And then, quite correctly, we started examining the real history. And Monticello is living testament to that. When I first came to Monticello in 1970 and had a tour, all of the people who worked at Monticello were described as servants, and they were ever so happy. But in fact, they were slaves. And now you hear that, you know that, you find the truth when you come here. So all of this has been for a purpose. All this re-examination and self-examination has been for a good purpose. But you can also go too far, and you can start repudiating every part of Jefferson's past because of the pieces of Jefferson with which you disagree. And I'd like to bring that back a little bit.
All you need is a rap show. All you need is a Broadway show.
You need a rap show. And you know what? Eventually he'll have one. You know, this has started a trend. It's Hamilton first, and we're going to work our way backwards.
Sabato candidly expressed his exasperation with the election campaign and the level of rhetoric about immigration and so many other issues. But there is, he says, the great equalizer.
Your power as an individual citizen is awesome. You can shake things up by speaking up, by starting a petition, organizing your neighbors, backing a candidate for office, or running yourself. And voting, of course. Voting, voting, always voting.
Larry Sabato actually used his speech to these new immigrants at Monticello to deliver his emotional plea for these excited new Americans to help out all of us old, jaded citizens. Please.
Help us to live up to American ideals. Make us better. With your international backgrounds, encourage your fellow citizens to build bridges, not walls. Join us in civic enterprises that will benefit everyone. We're counting on you. We know you'll come through just as generations of new citizens have for the entire existence of America. America, the beautiful, now and forever, your country. Congratulations to our new citizens and happy 4th, everyone.
Dr. Larry Sabato is founder and director of the University of Virginia's Center for Politics.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ or Curious Quotient through the game of lifelong learning. More at Curious.com/PRI. Audible, provider of audiobooks on topics ranging from astronomy to zombies. More at audible.com/listen. Audible, stories that surround you. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, along with John Hockenberry today. The debate over immigration and possible mass deportation is making the future uncertain for some immigrants in the United States, including some who have legal status here. Andrea Bonilla is a college freshman who grew up undocumented. She's now able to work legally and live openly thanks to a program called Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. President Obama created the initiative. Donald Trump has pledged to undo it if he's elected president. In the meantime, DACA and other programs face legal uncertainty in the courts. Andrea says the last year has really opened her eyes to the immigration debate. She was planning her transition from high school to college.
I feel like it didn't affect me until senior year. And then when I started applying for colleges, I really felt what being a DACA student meant. And it meant having to apply to college as an international student and then not getting the same opportunities as everybody. I realized how excluded I was and how I wasn't like everybody else. And now with the presidential election, I have realized that I could lose what I've gained, which is like the right to even be here where I am right now in college. Because before, people like me couldn't even go to a private college. So I feel like with DACA, I have gained a lot, but that could all be lost with a new president coming in.
What exactly is it you think you stand to lose?
One, I could be deported. I mean, that's the first thing. And then if I'm deported, I won't be able to get my education, which is what I've worked for since I got here. And I've earned the right to like be here. And then that could all be taken away just because of my legal status.
Now, you've asked attorneys, immigration attorneys, what could change for you if DACA is rescinded. It's not a law. It's just a presidential executive order, which means the next president can undo it if they want to. So what have the attorneys said that could mean for you?
They've said that people like me will have to go back to living in the shadows and that we have to work without papers, and some people might not even go to school, and it's just like back to being invisible in a way.
You know, at the same time, Andrea, I wonder how you think about one of the points that Donald Trump makes, which is that they want immigrants in this country. We want immigrants for our economy, but that the United States shouldn't send a message that the pathway to becoming an American citizen is to get here illegally. I mean, we do have laws for a reason. So when you hear him say that, does that make any sense to you?
I mean, it does make sense what he's saying, but it's like I came here illegally and it wasn't like my choice, and some people have to come here. Like, that's their only way of surviving.
How does this debate in this presidential election have you feeling about the way a lot of the country might view you in your adopted country?
It makes me feel discriminated and like excluded. And I'm just like, wow, like so many people support Donald Trump's ideas. And like, we can see that. We can see that in the polls. It's not like not a lot of people are voting for him. People are supporting his ideas. And it just, I don't know. I just feel like surprised and shocked because, I mean, it's just crazy how like so many people would just say deport people and like deport people like me. I just feel like shocked, I guess.
So do you really have a fear that you might have to leave, or is it more a fear that you might have to go back to the way things were, working in the shadows and hiding from authorities?
It's a fear of like the unknown, because even if Trump wins and he deports me, it's like I don't know what I'm going to be going to in Ecuador. Like my parents, they know what life is like there because they grew up there. I didn't. I grew up here. So it's just, I don't even know what to think.
Andrea Bonilla is a radio rookie, a DACA recipient, and a freshman at Lafayette College in Pennsylvania.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick along with John Hockenberry today. So Donald Trump spent almost all of last week softening and hardening and explaining and trying to soften again his immigration pitch to voters. You can kind of get used to the salesman-like pitch of all this, telling every audience what they want to hear, but that hides a deeper truth. Immigration and what to do about undocumented immigrants drives Republican-based politics and has driven it for years. And when you step back from the wall or anchor babies or deportation forces, what remains is that Donald Trump is in a very difficult spot between the Republican base and his need to attract new voters. And it also shows a problem for Republicans that isn't new and isn't going away after November, no matter who wins the election. Joining me now is Elise Foley, politics and immigration reporter for The Huffington Post. Elise, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
You know, back in 2012, when Mitt Romney ran for president, the nation watched him struggle a bit with a deportation policy, talking about self-deportation, other forms of deportation as he ran for president. This was a problem for Romney back then, and it was even a problem for Republicans before that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the big lessons, supposedly, of the 2012 election was that Republicans needed to talk about immigration differently. So you saw Mitt Romney say things like people needed to self-deport. He said that, but then that came back and was, you know, in ads. People talked about it in the general election, and it was attributed a lot. And, you know, who knows to what level this is true, but for Latino voters opposing him, you know, in such large numbers. So the Republicans have really presidential elections lost more and more Latino voters every election for the past few. And that caused this big reckoning that they needed to do something differently. But that clearly hasn't held.
And then the big question is, why hasn't it held, right? The Republican National Committee, the GOP itself, issued their documents, has famously now said we have to present immigration in a different way. As you said, we have to get right with more Latino voters. We can't just rely on white people. Here we are in 2016 with an immigration pitch from Donald Trump that has gone even further to the right than Mitt Romney ever was. It's the exact opposite direction that the party said it wanted to go in.
I think one thing in terms of the politics, the Republicans in the Senate, a lot of them voted for this comprehensive immigration reform bill in 2013. Along that, you know, that same message of 2012, we need to get right on immigration. So they went ahead and did that. And there was not necessarily a backlash in terms of all of them losing their seats, but there was a ton of criticism then it died in the House. Republicans there opposed it. So you saw then that, you know, politically a lot of Republicans were starting to lose their desire to stick their necks out on this or continuing to oppose it. And I think that's because a lot of people are still frustrated with the economy. It's easier to, you know, look at it and say there are immigrants taking our jobs than it is to think about that the economy of the U.S. might just be changing and the types of jobs might be changing.
So it's about this anxiety over the types of jobs that are changing. It seems to me this is also mixed in a very complicated way with a great deal of cultural grievance, right, among...
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you're always hearing things like English only in the same sentence as all of this. Why do we have to have things in Spanish on the ATMs? These criticisms all go together. So I think the culture changes are part of it as well.
And one thing that's for sure is that whether Donald Trump wins or loses, this isn't all about him. These are millions of voters who've supported his positions. They don't go away, and their attitude about immigration doesn't go away.
I think one of the big questions is what this means for immigration reform going forward. One thing that this has exposed is how many people are out there who really support Trump's message. So if I were, you know, a Republican lawmaker, that might make me nervous, even if Trump loses, to go ahead and support something like immigration reform, because now, you know, it's been proven that this is a really successful message.
Well, Elise, can you hang around for just one more minute with us?
Absolutely.
And we'll be right back on The Takeaway. Elise Foley is still with us here on The Takeaway, talking the future and the past of immigration. She's politics and immigration reporter for The Huffington Post. Welcome back, Elise.
Thanks.
So day one for the new president, whether it's Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, they would have different priorities in the Oval Office on immigration on their first day. But what's to be done immediately on this issue? There are Supreme Court decisions that are going to come down and executive orders waiting in the wings.
Yeah, so, I mean, for Trump, he could do maybe more things immediately. He could, you know, immediately end Obama's policies that are administration policies, things like the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program for these young undocumented people who came as kids. He could end that, you know, as quickly as he wanted to. For Clinton, I think it's a little different because a lot of the things she wants to do would be more in the vein of... passing some sort of immigration reform bill. And she could change policies as well. But a lot of the policies that she supports tend to be sort of similar to Obama administration policies. So I'm not sure how much she could do on day one other than start pushing for immigration reform.
Immigration reform has been a massive issue in this election. It is driving Republican politics and not going away no matter who wins. Elise Foley, politics and immigration reporter for The Huffington Post. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is John Hockenberry once again. Our thanks to Todd Zwillick. And we return now to Monticello, where The Takeaway attended the naturalization ceremony for a group of new Americans on July 4th of this year. We were also invited to be part of a discussion regarding immigration and the new president entering the Oval Office in January of 2017. This debate was sponsored by the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, and my guests were Daniel Tischner, Philip H. Knight Professor of Political Science and Program Director and Senior Scholar of the Wayne Morse Center for Law and Politics at the University of Oregon. He is currently an Andrew Carnegie Fellow as well. And David Martin joined us, the Warner Booker Distinguished Professor of International Law at the University of Virginia. He served as Principal Deputy General Counsel of the Department of Homeland Security from 2009 to 2010. What will it be regarding immigration, I asked? A small step in 2017 for the new president, or a big turn of the page? Daniel Tischner begins.
Incrementalists will say that the easiest things to take on would be areas where there's broad bipartisan agreement, like increasing skilled immigrants who come into the country. There's broad support on both the Democratic and Republican side in that regard. You would also have a lot of agreement that those who are so-called dreamers, young undocumented immigrants who came to the country when they were minors, that there should be special benefits and a path to citizenship for them. I would actually counsel a first-year president to go very differently, to think comprehensively. Those are particularly easy areas of agreement in Congress and on an issue that's so contentious. And in a sense, I think it's much more sensible to attach that to the tougher nuts to crack. I think comprehensive reform is probably what's the most necessary right now. We've been waiting for it. It's arduous. But to get any significant reform done at any point in our nation's history, it's required the creation of strange bedfellow coalitions. Even in our hyperpolarization between our parties now, we've never gotten anything done unless we've done that. And so
what coalition do you envision that would be strange bedfellows that gets beyond the bizarre Gang of Eight?
We're so accustomed to seeing our country as red state, blue state, conservative, liberal. I think your strange bedfellow coalition is trying to get the kind of Chamber of Commerce Republicans to work together with Democrats who want to see some solutions on this.
Practical?
I think it's quite practical in a way that most people don't appreciate. There's a lot of cynicism, understandable cynicism, about the chances for comprehensive reform because we've tried it. We tried it through in the middle 2000s. The Bush administration tried it. The Obama administration wanted to do it in 2009. It failed. 2013, the Senate passed a bill by a surprisingly wide margin, 68 to 32 votes, and it couldn't get even a hearing in the House. Beyond that, some of the real resistance comes from people who point back to our last experience with a legalization program in 1986, the Immigration Reform and Control Act, which had a legalization program and also had some new enforcement mechanisms. The legalization worked very well. Almost 3 million people were legalized. The enforcement provisions through employers checking documents, turned out was easily defeated by false documents. And so people point to that and say, well, we don't, many people who resist comprehensive reform say, we were fooled then, we're not going to be fooled. Now you have to prove to us first that enforcement will work. My message would be, this is not 1986. There have been enormous changes, underappreciated by most people, in the capacities of the government to do smart but still humane kinds of enforcement. A lot of that was developed because of all the resources that were poured into immigration control after 9/11. Many of those were designed in order to deal with a terrorist threat, which is a very tiny proportion of any aspiring immigrant population.
Can I interrupt you there? Is terrorism driving this issue, and is that a problem?
It's not necessarily. It did it at the time. It was completely understandable after the shock of 9/11. The resources were poured in, but it provided a number of techniques and systems that are way beyond the capacities that were there in the 1980s. I was on the transition team for the Obama administration in 2008 to 2009. I had been in the government in the Clinton administration in the mid-90s. I was really floored when we got our briefings on the range of things that are possible, including such things as instantaneous access to passenger manifests for vessels and planes that come in, so you could have a better way of knowing when people have overstayed their visas, people who have come in illegally, other kinds of fingerprint systems that keep track of people. You'll know when somebody has come across the border two or three times, and you can act appropriately. The systems are there. What it takes is an imaginative and thoughtful way of employing them. It really could be different from 1986, but we're not going to get there unless there's a combination of both legalization to protect people who've been here for a long time, so that they wouldn't be subjected to that, and new enforcement mechanisms. But it's really critical for a new president to demonstrate, to break through some of this mistrust, to demonstrate ways in which, yes, we're going to be serious about enforcement, but it has to be built on this combination. The first year will be the time to do it. It'll take a president who's willing to spend some political capital and incur some harsh criticism from their natural allies as well to put together that right kind of package. But I think it's doable.
Professor David Martin, along with Daniel Tischner, discussing the future of immigration policy in the United States.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com. Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors, and opinions from your fellow listeners. You can also check out the latest John Hockenberry blog post and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.
Here at Monticello, the Thomas Jefferson Home and the University of Virginia, he founded, I'm speaking with Daniel Tischner, Philip H. Knight Professor of Political Science
and Program Director and Senior Scholar of the Wayne Moore Center for Law and Politics at the University of Oregon, and also with David Martin, Warner Booker Distinguished Professor of International Law at the University of Virginia. He was General Counsel of the Department of Homeland Security from 2009 to 2010. Who does immigration well? That was our next focus. There's a need for quality, affordable workers in the United States economy, but also a need for security. Who's good at balancing those? We begin with a question from our thoughtful audience, many of whom had a personal stake in the immigration debate in America.
What are the political considerations going into do we or do we not try and go for comprehensive immigration reform next year?
Well, it's always a risk when you spend a lot of political capital early on that it won't work, and you'll then be in a worse position. But if you take that thinking to its logical conclusion, you wouldn't do much of any initiative. You just kind of try to patch weak spots here and there.
Well, that's what Clinton ended up in his second term. He was doing seatbelts. He had it with big issues.
Yeah,
and No Child Left Behind was Bush's timid sort of tiptoe into the first term.
As it happens, we have some strong statements from both the leading candidates that immigration is going to be one of the first things that they're going to deal with.
If I could just quickly add, traditionally presidents have tried to lay low on this issue because it has been a political minefield. Bill Clinton is a great example of this, where he did his best not to have to touch this issue and preferred to react to what Congress was going to do surrounding immigration. I don't think our most recent presidents don't have that luxury. And think about executive actions that have been taken, for instance, and how strong this issue has become for the base of each party.
We've heard some very strident and disturbing rhetoric coming from candidates in the campaign, and it wasn't just Donald Trump. There were other candidates who were talking very much about Americans and Christianity and speak English and all this sort of thing, that even Paul Ryan was outraged by and says, oh my goodness, this is just not who we are. So suddenly the immigration story is a posing of the question, well, who are we as Americans? If we can answer that question, we can start to deal with this. So how much tribalism do you think is driving this immigration debate? And how much of it is really a sense of the 21st century is just so complicated, all of our mechanisms are kind of outmoded, and we're just facing a kind of chaos? It's not tribal, it's just sort of chaos.
I would weigh in on saying so much of this rhetoric is tribal and demagogic. If you look over time, we've always been a country that has celebrated our immigrant past. And we wrap ourselves in that iconography, the Statue of Liberty, Ellis Island.
Japanese internment.
Yeah, but we've always dreaded the so-called immigrant present.
Right, the Chinese quotas.
Exactly.
Right.
So each period we could look at the newest kids on the block have been the problem. So Americans have this exceptional tradition of saying immigration as a process is virtuous if only the newest folks who are using the immigration system hadn't perverted what we think is a great process. We're a nation built upon immigration, but we've always been an incredibly uneasy nation of immigrants. And maybe I'm an inveterate optimist, but what stands out to me is if you look at public opinion polling over the last 20 years, in rather historic high levels, most Americans are embracing more immigration or keeping high levels of robust immigration the same, and embracing diverse immigration. Americans much more, in 86, a vast majority of Americans were furious about the idea of legalizing those roughly 3 million undocumented immigrants. That's not so today. A large majority either believe that we should legalize without any penalties or legalize with some kind of penalty. They're not saying no way, no how. So that actually is a shift. And I think we've always had that tribalistic component. I do think it is extremely exceptional that we're in an election where a chief presidential candidate has engaged in such hostile language about immigrants. And when it has happened, by the next election, you have seen a pivot. We're now in a moment where Mitt Romney got in trouble about the self-deportation comment, which seems tame compared to what we've heard from Donald Trump. So now we've had back-to-back elections where that pivot hasn't happened. So it really stands out historically.
David.
It is painful when tribalist comments are made, and there's certainly an appeal to a certain part of our population that really is based on that. But I don't think that that's the majority of people. The real political challenge right now is to try to craft policies and implement them over the next few years in a way that will deprive those who are making tribalist appeals of their ability to reach beyond the pure tribalists. There are a lot of people who support those kinds of ideas, crackdown kinds of ideas, I think out of a lot of different kinds of motives. Some because they really believe in the rule of law, and it's offensive that people who have knowingly violated the law would get this kind of a great benefit. For me, that's a matter of focusing on the future and getting to a point where there's a much better balance between enforcement and migration. We legalize a large number of the people who are here now and then focus those new steps on the future. And the point of enforcement is in part to deprive the tribalists and the demagogues of their ability to reach into the middle part of our population. Don't think about it a whole lot. They're somewhat troubled by illegal migration. They maybe know some people in their community who've worked hard, who've been there in that way. Get that more resolved. So that it's that complex mix, and it really, you know, I didn't expect it to get quite as nasty as it is in this election. If that actually winds up as a believed to be at least a key reason why that candidate loses, if that should happen, that may finally fortify enough people in Congress to decide let's actually act on this issue. Let's put this issue behind us for a while. That could be the pivot. It could be.
Now there's a piece of analysis in a well-discussed subject I hadn't heard. The concern over the rhetoric and sentiments regarding immigration coming from the Trump campaign might turn out in a Republican defeat to give Democrats the impetus to accomplish what they've failed to do on immigration reform on their own. That was David Martin along with Daniel Tischner discussing how immigration policy is shaping and being shaped by our current election.
I was younger than you are now when I was given my first command. I led my men straight into a massacre.
And here's something to take with you today. According to U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, in fiscal year 2015, 729,995 people said the oath and became citizens. Over the last decade, the U.S. welcomed the equivalent of two cities roughly the size of Los Angeles. For those of us who have not stood and declared an oath, are we certain of our commitment to this nation we claim membership to without a thought?
History has its own.
I hereby declare, on oath, that I absolutely and entirely renounce and abjure all allegiance and fidelity to any foreign prince, potentate, state, or sovereignty,
of whom or which I have heretofore been a subject or citizen, that I will support and defend the Constitution and laws of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic,
that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that I will bear arms on behalf of the United States when required by the law,
that I will perform non-combatant service in the armed forces of the United States when required by the law,
that I will perform work of national importance under civilian direction when required by the law,
and that I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, so help me God.
Will we as Americans commit ourselves to resolving an impasse over immigration that has gone on through two presidencies now? History has its eyes on us. That's the takeaway for this Labor Day. Thanks for listening. I'm John Hockenberry with Todd Zwillick. See you all back at work.
I know that greatness lies in you.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.